All right, so we're here today with Dr. Scott Morganson. Hi.
Hello.
Scott Morganson is a professor at Queen's University at the Gender Studies Department. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself, Scott?
Absolutely. First, thank you so much, Kim, for this invitation. It's a real pleasure to be able to talk with you and everybody listening today. And I did come to the Department of Gender Studies in the summer of 2009, so I just finished my second year at Queen's, yay, and really enjoying working with my colleagues and at Queen's and with all the fabulous students. And I come from the United States, and my research for quite a while now has been providing a critique of racism and settler colonialism in queer politics in the United States, and now as I live here increasingly in Canada. And let's see, I do that work, I have a long-term commitment to practicing alliance politics with anti-racist and anti-colonial feminist and queer and trans movements. So so my research has come out of those grounded political stakes, and identify as a white queer cisgender man, and I do understand that I was raised on colonized indigenous land and that I've lived within settler states. So doing this research really does integrate kind of my own personal positioning of myself and my sense of my politics or activism with the kind of productive work that I think scholars can do in the academy to increase knowledge and raise consciousness about important issues.
So now you've been, like you've said earlier, you've been pretty outspoken on your critiques against settler colonialism and homonationalism. Can you give us a bit of a working definition for both?
Sure. It's a good question because both of those terms, maybe even settler colonialism more so, can seem almost like they have a straightforward definition, but people talk about them in pretty nuanced ways. Mm-hmm. First of all, I like to make sure that people know that when I'm talking about settler colonialism, I'm talking about something that's very, very important for all of us who are living here in Canada or who live in any country like Canada, the United States, Australia, Aotearoa, New Zealand, and many other states around the world that were formed through the settlement of indigenous lands and the displacement of indigenous nations by settlers who are also conquerors. So in a concert with many senior members of the Canadian Academy, Shireen Razek and Arthur Bonney, who visited Queen's recently, I use this language of settler colonialism to recognize Canada as a settler state. It comes into existence through a history of settler colonialism, and because Indigenous nations never disappeared and continue to assert their sovereignty, that means that Canada is still a settler colonial state right now. Now, that end point of the argument can feel kind of contentious for many people who have been raised to think of a country like Canada as inclusive, multicultural, democratic, liberal, and free, and that somehow vestments and those kinds of values somehow, I don't know, maybe makes up for the fact that, which we all know, I think, that it originates in conquest. I would argue that actually the attempt to make a country like Canada be inclusive and multicultural and globalized is precisely an attempt to naturalize, to appear natural, the history of colonialism that undergirds the state. And in effect, it's even an attempt to bring not only European settlers, but now people of color from around the world to participate in a project of ongoing settlement and conquest of lands that indigenous nations, as I've already said, still assert sovereignty over. This form of colonization, this settler colonialism, so that's part of how I would talk about settler colonialism. In that sense, we can distinguish it from colonialism. Whether you think of colonialism as sort of the overarching category in settler colonialism is a version of it. Some scholars say that. Other scholars actually draw a break and say colonialism is one thing and settler colonialism is a totally different animal. I'm not sure how I fall down on that one right now, but the distinction that is helpful to draw is that most forms of colonialism that we're aware of happen at a distance. Their purpose is to create an empire. where the rulers of the empire live where they came from, and they rule over other people and try to maintain the difference between themselves and the other people across distances of geography, obviously, but also of culture. This is where you get a very strong distinction between the imperial culture and the culture of the other that has to be racialized as different and kept away from itself. And so that we're familiar with that form of colonization because it's the one that attempted to be ended during the 20th century in the decolonization of Africa and Asia. But settler colonialism isn't absolutely different from that, but it does draw a distinction because since its purpose is actually to bring the members of the empire to the land of the people who they're now going to conquer and settle them, it actually has the purpose of making this new, for the settlers, new land, this conquered land, belong to them and actually be the source of their own identity. Settlers still understand themselves as related to the countries of origin and the cultural of origin. That's obvious. But you get from settler colonialism the result that settlers actually think that they belong to the land where their ancestors, you know, violently moved. And also settlers take on this sense that the people who they replaced actually are gone. So they still think of indigenous peoples as different, but this difference isn't one that where one is holding people at a great arm's length. In fact, one of the ways that we see settler colonialism functioning is by presuming that indigenous culture is actually owned by settlers now, and that they can perform it themselves. This is where you get white people walking around pretending to be Indian and fake Indian, fake native religious ceremonies. You get the desire on the part of white people in a settler society to think of indigenous culture as part of their own history, you know, collecting indigenous artifacts and not from however long a period of time ago without any relationship to the indigenous peoples whose ancestors' lives they're disturbing. So there's this interesting difference between colonialism and settler colonialism in this sense. And so whereas Africa and Asia remain in the mind of Europe as a difference that never disappears, indigenous peoples in the Americas are fantasized as people who not only are always disappearing, but disappeared a long time ago. And that's part of how the myth of settler colonialism perpetuates itself. Now, so that's a little bit of... a lot of background on that. I got to this, like, how did I learn how to talk like that? I mean, I was just a white suburban kid from California. Nobody taught me to think critically about racism, even, much less how settler colonialism brought racism, as we know it, to this land. I got it by struggling with racism in the queer community. So I basically got it by struggling with this thing that we call homonationalism. So a real basic definition of homonationalism, this term and the way that we use it was defined by a professor of women's studies at Rutgers University, Jasbir Poolar. And homonationalism basically refers to queer movements, sometimes inclusive of trans movements, but we could talk about why actually trans movements have often had a critique of homonationalism that queer movements that weren't invested in trans politics didn't get. Homonationalism refers to queer movements that free themselves from sexual and gender oppression by aligning with the power of the state. And so it doesn't just mean that a queer movement that is nationalistic, that is patriotic or supports in which it exists. It refers more to the idea that the best way to solve gender oppression and the best way to solve sexual oppression is to become part of a state that will protect you from the people that potentially pose you harm. But the flip side of that, of course, is that if a queer movement is aligning itself with the state saying, you know, protect us, it also is suggesting that a queer movement gets free by joining the state and becoming part of whatever the state is doing. This is why some of the things that the critics of homonationalism often point to as examples of it are the refocusing of queer politics from issues like structural violence or economic inequality, homelessness, the experiences of queer and trans sex workers, any range of things that have to do with the severe economic marginalization and social marginalization that affects our broad scope of our communities, and instead refocuses queer politics on, you know, getting to be married or getting to join the military and be full participants in all of the work that the military does. Or becoming representatives of that state when its military force gets projected around the world and takes over the countries that it occupies and trains the people in those other societies to live more like the people that the military represents. You know, these kinds of destinations for queer politics are things that we would be questioning and critiquing when we have a critique of homonationalism.
And what was your... what was your journey like to it? Like, how did you, you said you grew up in a suburban neighborhood. So, like, what were the particular things that actually brought out these critiques for you?
Yeah. Well, if I had sort of gotten involved in a queer community in my, in the area where I grew up, which was a part of Los Angeles, at that time, if I'd gotten involved in that community at a younger age, I may have come to some understanding of this before I went to university. But like some people who, like some other people, I gained this analysis after I went to a university. And I come from a mixed class background, and I am a first-generation college student, so I was on scholarship and also working and paying my way to university. I didn't really know why I was there, and hardly anybody else in my family knew either. So for me, when I say that I'm very much positioning like my analysis as I got this from organizing in the university context, but I actually think of that as not necessarily suggesting that the critique that I learned is specific to the university, because it made sense to me as someone who comes from a family that had nothing to do with higher education. When I got there, you know, university is an interesting place because it brings people, although within sometimes a very narrow economic window, it brings people from all over a state or a province or a country or even the world sometimes, and mixes them up and then asks them to think together at this very important time in their life, after they've been legally recognized as adults and are being asked to take responsibility for their life and for the world, and asks them to figure out how to work together. So when you form if you try to form a GLBT alliance in a university context that's working and that works like this, it sometimes has sort of more racial, ethnic, national, cultural, maybe gender and sexual, sometimes even class diversity than the queer movement that exists, say, in the community around it, you know, or in the region. If the region isn't itself as diverse in the ways I just described as the university has made itself to be. And that was my experience. I think this is all kind of ironic for me to say this, because I think we're all aware of how not diverse most of the universities are that we've been in, and there's this very strong critique of a culture of whiteness at Queens, which I'm completely on board with. But, you know, ironically, even Queens is more diverse than some queer communities that are around, you know, it, and that was also the case for me. When I went to the university, I was meeting people that I would never have otherwise met, and we struggled over our differences. And just to wrap this thread together, there was a lot of debate about racism in the queer community in the 90s, which is the time period I'm referring to, in California. And in queer communities in the L.A. area and the San Francisco area, both of which I happened to be living in at the time, I got involved in those debates. And the place that took me to was this. No matter how much we struggled around racism in our community, it didn't really seem to go away. Like, it became more and more apparent that white queer people, despite the fact that they suffered from sexual and gender oppression, had not necessarily come to an awareness that they were white people, that they benefited from racism directed towards people of color, and that they could reproduce that racism in their behavior. But even if we got to a point of like acknowledging those things, the racism that was being identified didn't necessarily leave. And I think one of the reasons why, and this is why I wrote my book the way I did, is because queer people, having suffered from so much sexual and gender oppression, really, really, really want to find acceptance and love with one another. It's a very strong theme in our organizing, at least in the North American context, towards, you know, like finding that thread that links all queer people together.
Right.
And it often has to do with these feelings of, you know, affection or love articulated by our relationships with each other and our attempts to create safe spaces, which are often safe spaces for people to meet and form relationships. You know, so I think the emphasis on our need to love one another so desperately because we live in a world that so doesn't love us is one of the problems. It's like it's our Achilles heel.
Yeah.
Because we are so intent on creating a culture of loving each other that we don't notice that it's not possible for queer people of color to find love in a space that is structurally and culturally violent towards them. And if it gets internalized, right, it's going to even affect the ability for queer people of color to love one another, much less being able to work in a white queer space. And as long as queer spaces remain defined by the lives and interests and experiences of white people, there's always going to be a form of racism there somehow. Because, and this is where, you know, settler colonialism comes in, because there wouldn't be any queer communities as we know them, these multiracial, transnational, diverse queer communities on this land. There wouldn't be any queer communities like we know them on this land if it hadn't been settled by primarily the people who arrived after the conquest. And if you ever want to, and so that I finally got educated in this by Native activists, and I also got it by noticing that one of the little stories that sometimes white queer communities tell themselves to explain, you know, why they're so integral, you know, the thing that really draws them together in love, is often been by going back to the histories of Native American societies on this land and finding that so many, and not all by any means, but so many Native nations across the Americas historically and still accepted gender and sexual diversity as parts of cultural tradition, very meaningful. And that story circulated very widely in the queer communities I lived in. In fact, I often would, or you know, I would be working as an accountable white ally to queer activists of color. We'd be trying to raise the issue of racism in the community. Be like, you know, just whatever issue we were talking about. This issue is dividing us. This issue is causing discord in our community, and we have to address it. And the answer would be like, oh, but we all share a culture, right? Don't you know anything about the histories of Two-Spirit people? You know, or right? Or we share a history. Like, how we shouldn't fight so much around these. These are small matters in the present moment. Can we get back? We need to get back to that common place. It's very interesting, these gestures. It's not constant, right? But I noticed it was interesting enough to notice. A lot of the time, like the gesture, like that thing that really holds us together, is basically a white cultural appropriation of Native culture that had been taken in out of its Native context and here to a context that served the purpose, which I guess it was a twofold purpose. One was to make white people feel better about themselves while living on occupied Native land, because rather than having to feel like settlers, they get to feel like they are part of Native culture or own a piece of Native culture and belong here somehow. The other thing that was useful about it is that it allows that move I just referenced, where in the face of saying, actually, racism and racial, ethnic, national differences, they divide us from one another a lot of the time. We're not always supposed to be one community, say, some queer activists of color or white anti-racist queer activists would be saying. And the response is, well, actually, we are supposed to be more alike one another than different. And so citing that Native history is useful sometimes to a queer politics that wants us to be focused more on unity than on acknowledging our sometimes irreconcilable differences. And I think that taught me a lot. It taught me about racism. It taught me about settler colonialism. But it also taught me that I actually don't really believe that there has to be one queer politics. And I'm very suspicious of any suggestion that the only possible queer politics is a queer politics in which everyone does the same thing at the same time and agrees with one another. We actually come from very, very different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Our politics actually are irreconcilable sometimes. Mm-hmm. If you want to be a settler colonist, I know some queer people who are going to tell you that they don't want you around. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter that you're both queer. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. And so these are very contentious and important issues we need to struggle over. And anyway, we've been struggling over them for generations and decades. Mm-hmm. It's not new. Hopefully, mm-hmm. so many of the things I'm saying are not new information to a lot of the listeners. But that's part of how I got involved. It's struggling around, struggling on racism in the community and seeing that it actually connected to a larger story about colonialism and then the implications for the kinds of queer movements we form in response.
Mm-hmm. And how have you seen it sort of play out in the last couple of years with LGBT mainstream organizing and radical queer organizing?
Yeah, well, we've all seen the examples. I've sort of tangentially referenced struggles over gaining same rights to same gender, same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. And the effort to secure and to protect the rights of LGBT people to participate in military service. Mm. Now, obviously, the incompletion of those two forms of civil right, the fact that they're still not granted at a federal level in the United States, mm-hmm. whereas they are both granted at a federal level in Canada. Mm-hmm. So, my experience in the last, say, 10 years has been that these are very pressing issues, very front and center, but the chronology might be a little different here. Mm-hmm. But certainly, I think that when we see queer movements, as I've said before, really only focusing on what can the state give us, and then the implication of that is what can we do for the state? We might also want to think about what do we or do members of our communities have interests that are about getting this, like, is it in the interest of any queer trans people to actually get the state further away from them than it already has managed to become? Mm-hmm. And sometimes you start thinking about this when you think about people who are living on the economic margins, mm-hmm. people who have, who, like I know from a Newcast context, who are struggling with the welfare system, mm-hmm. The kinds of expectations that come down to the system, or what kind of relationship you can belong in order to get state assistance. Mm-hmm. And I could make a long list, even just... the sense that we have in Canada that sex work has been legitimated somehow because it appears to be criminalized, mm-hmm. when obviously people who are practicing in the sex trades are facing an enormous number of mm-hmm. vulnerabilities to daily violence, to lack of access to resources. Mm-hmm. Queer and trans sex workers are part of the queer community. Why are we not making the people who are the most marginal and the most stigmatized in our communities the poster children? Why do the poster children mm-hmm. always look middle class, well fed, at mm-hmm. their cottage, enjoying a trip on a cruise ship to a recently decolonized country in the Caribbean where they appreciate consuming the cultures of African diasporic mm-hmm. people and indigenous people and then take back little trinkets to their white middle class lives? This kind of culture is very deeply problematic. To the extent that we think that that's the horizon mm-hmm. of queer freedom, then we are saying that queerness is about consumption, it's about conformity, mm-hmm. it's about not questioning structural violence, mm-hmm. it's about thinking that your movement doesn't actually have a political angle except to the extent that it makes its members economically and socially and culturally and religiously, like, comfortable mm-hmm. within a society and a world that's still patently racist, economically exploitative, mm-hmm. you know, and just violent in so many ways. So mm-hmm. I don't, sorry, I don't really want to be part of a queer movement that doesn't want to take, you know, doesn't want to take seriously the possibility that to protect our own, we must critique the state. Mm-hmm. To protect our own, we must distance some of our own, or mm-hmm. possibly all of us, from the power that the state would like to project into our lives. Mm-hmm. That to protect ourselves from violence, we must criticize the way that nationalism gets deployed. Mm-hmm. To get us to buy in to agendas that are actually killing people, mm-hmm. and sometimes killing our own people, right? Mm-hmm. If you think of this as a community, and it's about our community,
yeah.
You know, when guns get pointed at other people here on this land or on another land overseas, why is there a presumption that the queer people who have been empowered to point those guns are pointing them at other queer people?
Mm-hmm.
And actually, should we only critique that complicity in militarism if the people at the other end of the gun are queer? Or shouldn't we actually be critiquing it regardless of who right. the people on the other end of the gun are? Right?
Yeah.
So I think that we need a... But I have noticed that that this is... So, you know, I noticed it around the marriage and the military issues mostly, but there's so many others. There's mm-hmm. so many others we need to be paying.
Well, in the last couple of years or so, we've seen sort of a surge of, like, mainly around, I would say, because of Queers Against Australia Apartheid in Toronto, sort of mainstream coverage for queer groups that are providing critique against the Israeli state. So what do you think the dangers are in, like, couching critiques of settler colonialism in places like Israel-Palestine as opposed to Canada and the United States?
Yeah, such an interesting topic. So I would love to continue to talk about this with people because I'm hoping to do some research on this over the next few years across Canada with other scholars. And, you know, I arrived in Canada right at the time that the debate over Queers Against Israeli Apartheid, or I'll call it QAIA,
mm-hmm.
that the debate around QAIA was really erupting in Toronto mm-hmm. in 2009. That was leading up to the initial ban on their participation in Pride 2010, mm-hmm. which, of course, the Pride Committee then soon reversed
mm-hmm.
after protests from members of the Toronto and Canadian queer communities,
mm-hmm.
Including former awardees of the Toronto Pride Awards, over 20 of whom stood up in a public press conference and gave back their awards or refused to accept a new award
mm-hmm.
unless QAIA was readmitted to Pride.
Mm-hmm.
And I think among many things that they were saying, one of them was this was a critique of homonormativity and homonationalism,
mm-hmm.
the sense that Pride in Toronto had become all about consumption and conformity and had
mm-hmm.
lost its political roots
mm-hmm.
and its political spine.
Mm-hmm.
And that the idea that a group of self-identifying queer people who are in solidarity with other self-identifying queer people would be banned from Pride simply because they're taking a political position that some other people in the community find to be noxious is not in and of itself
mm-hmm.
enough of a reason to not allow them to be participating
mm-hmm.
in the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously I'm an advocate for free speech in this case, and I think that at the very least we should seriously question any attempt to say that simply because QAIA critiques the Israeli state or uses the category apartheid that they should be banned from speech
mm-hmm.
or banned from being able to air their position, especially when apartheid is an internationally recognized analytical category
mm-hmm.
under UN regulations and has been for almost 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
With that background, I think it's helpful to notice that there's no way for anyone in the Canadian context, any queer identifying, any people associated with Canadian queer and trans politics, that's what I really mean to say here, there's no way for anyone to ignore this debate because it's raised the issue of Israel-Palestine for
mm-hmm.
everyone. You know, we all have to ask the question now, what should Pride do? Who should it include? Can QAIA be part of what it includes? What does it mean if QAIA participates in Pride? And because Quiet's critique is against the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories. It's a race issue of racism and settler colonialism for Fell to discuss. So I just think that's inherently a good thing from the point of view of someone who's been trying to talk about racism and settler colonialism and mm-hmm. Canadian and U.S. queer politics for a really long time. That's my first response, mm-hmm. right? As someone who has been learning from Indigenous queer and Two-Spirit activists for decades, that queer people on this land need to talk about racism and settler colonialism, and finding year after year after year that hardly anybody wants to do that, I found it kind of refreshing that this mm-hmm. debate over Quiet actually raised these two issues for mm-hmm. us all to struggle over, and everyone's talking about it across the country now.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the way you phrased the question, because it suggests that we might be missing something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I just referenced it. You know, I did get the analysis I've shared today by struggling within my own sort of GLBT queer alliances.
Mm-hmm.
But those alliances that I struggled with in California were primarily non-Native.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we might have told stories or heard stories about Native culture, but there are very rarely Native-identified people in the room
mm-hmm.
saying those stories or even hearing them. And this has to do with the history of colonial violence and the racism that has not only seriously marginalized Native communities on their own land, but also contributed to queer communities forming and even having seen like they have the right to talk about Native issues without there ever being any Native people present. So I think that you know, queer politics in Canada already had a settler colonialism problem and a racism problem before Quiet and its mm-hmm. debate came along. And to the extent that we start talking about these issues now that we're talking about Quiet, and I'm not, and you see, I'm leaving it open, right,
mm-hmm.
for all the listeners. I don't know. There's probably a great diversity of opinions,
mm-hmm.
you know, about whether racism or settler colonialism even is a category that should be discussed in relationship to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of what we're debating. But mm-hmm. so all I'm saying here is not a particular position on that right now. I'm just saying like we're all having different opinions about whether or not or how we would talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
But to the extent that we continue to talk about or whether or how we should talk about this mm-hmm. topic in relationship to Israel-Palestine on this land and ignore the fact that we already knew that we participate in queer politics on stolen indigenous land
mm-hmm.
in a settler state
mm-hmm.
where racism is structured around racism against indigenous Americans before it's structured against anybody else
mm-hmm.
and as a context in which it gets structured against everyone that it ends up targeting. We really need to talk about this context too. So I want to actually suggest something I haven't heard very often from other people, which is let's keep struggling. Let's keep debating the issues raised by Quiet and its participation in Canadian queer politics.
Mm-hmm.
But let's do it by beginning to connect that discussion to a reinvestigation.
Mm-hmm.
How does racism and settler colonialism constitute our movements and our politics on this stolen indigenous land that is Turtle Island?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one way we can be led in this is by listening to indigenous Americans and Palestinians who are forming alliances with one another to talk about their various experiences of military occupation
mm-hmm.
and their struggles to get those experiences of military occupation heard in a world that too often seems like it just isn't really interested.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a nice place to end things.
Great.
Right now.
Hey, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I have actually one small last question. Is do you have any song requests?
Oh, yes. Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I would love it if you would play the Human League Lebanon.
All right.
If you want to get back into your 80s British invasion moment. I was just having a conversation with my colleague, Jay Kehalani Kawanui, who is a Kanaka Maoli Native Hawaiian feminist and associate professor at Wesleyan University. and who also is DJ Pineapple Crush on Wesleyan's local Unity Station. And we were talking about the politics of that was actually present in what often gets represented as a very apolitical genre.
Mm.
But go back to the Human League of all people.
Okay.
You know, see someone critiquing, who's aware of the violence that was going on in Lebanon. The other one I would go to is Heaven 17. We don't need this fascist groove thing.
Okay.
Thanks for
no problem. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you. If you ever need that, you want an extra DJ on your show, just give me a...
Oh! Right. Oh my gosh, so exciting.
thank you again, Kim.
No problem.